Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we're going to be talking with Pam Greenwood, a 15-year veteran of the Albemarle County Police Department, about her experiences on the force. Welcome, Pam.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for being here today. Why don't you give me a little bit of background about yourself before we get going? Where'd you grow up, and where'd you go to school, and how'd you end up on the PD?
Born in Ohio. Lived there till I was about 8, moved to Oklahoma for my father's job.
Mm-hmm.
And then, since I could remember, I wanted to be a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
I think I started playing chips at when I got to second grade.
Chips, like the old TV show?
Yeah.
Boy, you're showing our age here.
I was always Ponch, because I thought he was the cool, good-looking one.
All right, good to know.
Long and short of it is, I joined the military. Didn't want to go to school right away.
Mm-hmm. You joined the military right out of high school?
Yes, I did.
What
actually, when I was
service?
17.
When you were 17, can you do that?
Yep.
Or
your parents
lie?
Can sign a waiver.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what branch of the service?
Air Force.
Gotcha. And how long were you in the Air Force?
4 years.
Okay. And then what?
Well, I moved to Virginia via first relationship and landed here in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful place. I love it here. Wanted to pursue my dream at this time of being a police officer.
Okay. Now you are my age.
Yes.
I will reveal that I am 44 years old, thus outing you as well.
That's right.
And rumor has it you're a lesbian, Pam.
That is no rumor.
I've heard that.
quite accurate.
And so military service, went into the police force. You're also, I mean, people can't see you on the radio, so I'm going to describe you. You're about 5'4". 120 pounds. You're not a big bruiser of a gal. And you're very pretty, but you got kind of a tough look. You got some tattoos going, and, you know, I wouldn't mess with you. And I'm sort of curious about how that went for you in terms of, you know, when you first joined the PD, did you have any issues with just being physically small or any of those things?
Oh, yeah. All of those things. I feel pretty confident about myself and my athleticism and things like that. But yeah, it was pretty tough when the people that I mm-hmm. worked with were 6'4" and, you know, towered over me.
Well, and how about the people you were trying to arrest?
Actually, yeah. It seemed like the larger people, for some reason, were quite cooperative with me. And it was typically the smaller people that squared off.
Maybe they had good manners.
I think it was an eye-to-eye thing, and they saw it as a challenge. Like, she's my size, maybe I can take her.
Oh, I see.
and the larger ones seemed to be very... I didn't have much of a problem.
I gotcha. So you joined the PD what year?
In 1997.
And at that time, did you join the PD and then go to police academy, or did you go to police academy first?
Police academy. First.
Okay.
12 weeks of academy study.
Okay. So when did you get out of the academy?
I believe I entered in March, so graduated sometime in June.
Okay. Well, tell me about your first experiences on the police force. What was that first month like?
Well, it was very interesting. One of my first interactions with an officer was about my sexual orientation.
What do you mean?
Well, I was flat out asked if I had a girlfriend, a wife, a husband, a boyfriend, was I bisexual, or did I do other things?
Other things? Did they specify what kind of other things?
In context, I felt like I was asked if I did threesomes.
Oh, I see.
Or swung.
Uh-huh. If you were a swinger.
Yes.
Okay. In what context were you having that conversation?
My first day stepping into a police car.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how'd you deal with that?
Well, I was a little bit shocked that this was my first interaction and wondering what the heck was happening at uh-huh. that time. Didn't know how to answer. I remained very silent, and we drove.
Okay.
And I was eager to do my job. I was eager to learn my job. I wasn't eager to talk about my personal life at my dream job, workplace. You know, the place that I had in my head and, you know, the rosy glasses of I'm going to be that police officer that's going to go out. I'm going to help somebody. I'm going to save a life. For me, it wasn't about going out and seeing how many people I could wrangle in the back of my police car.
Right. Okay. So what happened as you went on that month? That was your first interaction. Did that sort of stop or what happened?
Being 26 years old, I swept it under the rug.
Right. You were like,
felt like, yes.
Chalk it up. Let it go.
Let it go. This is my self-preservation mode.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get off probation. I want to be a police officer, and I want to freaking do my job.
Now, when you say probation, I mean, you just started. You weren't on probation because you'd done anything wrong.
No.
You were on probation because everybody who's hired initially goes through a probation period, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, how long is the probation period?
I want to say that it was 6 months at the time. Now, that could have changed.
Okay.
Maybe it's a year now, which...
All right. So how'd your probationary period go?
It was very stressful. There was the stress of learning the street and learning my job. But then there was the added stress of harassment within the actual department.
What do you mean? Tell me what happened.
There were several people in authoritative positions that tried to take advantage of me as a young female. Also, the quote-unquote rumor then that I may be gay.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was scared to just be myself and scared to say, hey, you know, have a girlfriend. This is who I am. I was actually a little terrified.
Well, it was 97. So let's see. That was Bowers v. Hardwick territory. I mean, it was a felony to be homosexual. I mean, it was a felony to do anything about it. So I can see kind of how that would shape your concerns at that point.
Yeah.
As a young attorney, I mean, I graduated law school in 96, and I remember, you know, kind of thinking to myself, oh, man, you know, how can I do this? How can I enter this, you know, I wanted to be a criminal defense attorney. How can I enter this sort of criminal justice system as an officer of the court and be this criminal?
Right.
You know. Not that I'm admitting that I ever had any sex until after Lawrence v. Texas was passed.
That's right.
But I certainly thought about it. Okay, so how did things develop?
Well, I mean, I had good days, and I did have many people that treated me fairly and genuinely concerned. I actually had some coworkers come to me and ask me if I was okay after witnessing some very awkward behavior in the hallways from typically... an authority figure there and wanting to get through this probationary period and follow my dream of being a cop. I was willing to endure just about anything.
Was it sort of like being hazed?
It was more than being hazed. It wasn't like I was going to be joined into a brotherhood because I was never going to be part of a brotherhood there.
You were not going to be a brother.
I didn't want to be. I wanted to be a police officer who did the right thing and made the right decisions.
Okay. Did you at some point have an interaction with a superior officer that was kind of more overt?
Yes.
Tell me what happened.
Oh.
Don't tell me who it was. I don't want to hear that.
I was literally propositioned in an office.
How did that happen?
Where I felt trapped. How did it happen?
Yeah. How did it happen?
Well, I was actually studying at Piedmont College. Mm-hmm. And through a fellow student,
mm-hmm.
apparently there was something going on that I was unaware of with mm-hmm. this person of authority.
Mm-hmm.
And she befriended me.
Mm-hmm.
And unbeknownst to me, these two have cooked up a plan
mm-hmm.
to proposition me,
okay.
Knowing that I was... lesbian.
Okay.
And am still lesbian. And he basically used his position of authority to try to, I would say, terrorize me as a young officer. And this went on for many years.
Were you basically, when you say proposition, do you mean you were invited to engage in sexual activity?
Yes.
And did you accept that invitation?
Not at all.
How'd that go?
Well, that turned into years of harassment that I kept internally because I wanted my job. I always wanted to be a police officer. Yes, I could move on to do other things. I was a jet engine mechanic in the Air Force. That was an option. But when you find your dream job, you want to keep it, and nothing's going to keep you from it. And I was also looking out for other people, you know. I guess I was trying to be strong and trying to create a change for the future of any other female officers coming in there. So I endured a lot. I was diagnosed with 2 bleeding ulcers, which were not related to H. pylori virus, because of the constant harassment, threats behind the scenes.
When you say threats, what kind of threats?
There was interaction. Again, it was always one-on-one. And basically, I was told that, you know, I know something about your background that could be harmful here. However, it was something in my background and where I was a victim. And it was an investigation conducted there when I was younger. It was nothing I did wrong. And that to me, again, it scared me because that's a very personal part of my life. That
was it a threat to publicize that information?
It was a yes, exactly.
And what was the goal of the threat? What did the person want?
I can't speculate on what the person wanted, but I can say that I felt that definitely he didn't want me to go to anybody higher than him to turn this in.
He didn't want you to talk about what he was doing.
Right. But the general feeling that I had, it was a very hostile interaction any time with this individual. And I don't get scared much at all. Sure, 15 years of police work, I was scared plenty. But when I'm talking about scared and you feel threatened, that's not something I feel too often.
Right.
I felt scared and threatened from this person.
I see. And how long did you have to work with that person?
The entire 15 years I was there.
How'd you make it 15 years?
Well, at some point, something was investigated on my behalf without my knowledge.
I see.
And there were some actions taken that suppressed a lot of the behavior. But it lessened. But it was still present.
In other words, the harassment became less because it had been made known.
Correct.
Generally in the department.
That's right.
And some actions were taken, but it didn't go away.
Right. And I still felt like I was paying for not conceding, for not honoring the request.
Not agreeing to have sex with this person?
Yes.
And how did other people in the department treat you after that? After that came out, I mean, it's my understanding that sometimes in a police force or a military unit or something where there's this kind of close cohesion and a kind of a feeling of you're on the force, you're in the group or you're not in the group. If you take some action to blow the whistle on something in that group, you can suffer some repercussions.
I did. I suffered a lot of repercussions, but there was also a lot of support from my peers. There were a couple of people in a position of authority that did come to me and speak to me and support me. But
that's
it
good.
Just seemed like there was a general feel of fear to really do anything interdepartmentally.
I understand.
And then I felt kind of, I don't want to use the term blackballed. I think that's a little too strong. However, I was looked at as suspicious, even though I was the victim in this.
Right, because you kind of broke the code by pointing something out.
The kicker is it wasn't even me but I am very grateful.
It wasn't you that blew the whistle on it.
Right. In hindsight, I'm very grateful. At the time, I felt a lot of anger about all of it. And then, of course, in retrospect, you always wish you now could be you then.
Right. What would you do different?
Well, am I allowed to say something physical that I would like to do?
Well, let's not make any threats over
okay.
the...
I definitely, knowing what I know now, then I would have handled it. I would have taken a stand on the biggest soapbox and blown a whistle.
You would have been more direct.
Yeah, and I feel like that's my failure. And if anybody else endured any kind of behavior like that after me failing to do that, I apologize.
Because you feel like maybe you could have made it better if you'd taken
yes.
a stronger stand at the time.
Absolutely.
Well, but I mean, how old were you, Pam?
26. In fact, just turned 26.
You were an adult, but you're still a kid.
I was a kid. I agree.
Wow. So you had this personal experience, which sounds really heinous. But you were also in that department seeing many other people go through the department, many other interactions. What was the... let me ask you this first. Do you think you had this experience because you're a woman officer? Do you think you had this experience because you were a lesbian? Or do you think you just had this experience because of something individual?
I think I had the experience because this person knew something about me as a youth.
Mm-hmm.
Something terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I want to...
Not your fault. But...
Not my fault. And then the combination of being a woman and a lesbian, definitely, with the sexual innuendos, the propositions. It seemed to be a general feel at that time that if you were lesbian or gay, their first thoughts would go to a bedroom, not to you as the individual.
Right. Like, so there was sort of an idea that if you were gay, therefore you must be more amenable to having a swinger relationship or a threesome or something like that.
Yes.
I see.
And I'm not judgmental at all.
Right.
I mean, by all means, people can do what they choose. However, that's...
It just wasn't where you were at.
Wasn't my choice.
I understand.
Or to be coerced into something. It was... To me, it's equivalent of a sexual assault.
Right.
Being coerced or threatened that way.
I understand.
It's a verbal sexual assault.
Sure. Did you... what did you witness in regard to other people and treatment of women? Or were there even any other gay people there at the time?
There was one other gay female, mm-hmm. lesbian. She left shortly after she started there.
So she didn't stay very long?
No.
Got it. What about other females in the department? What did you see generally in terms of the culture of the department regarding women officers?
Well, it was... I heard statements in reference to these female officers. We have different backgrounds, different cultures, different races.
Mm-hmm.
And those around me, and at one point somebody of authority, referred to females as a redneck, H-W-H-O-R-E.
Mm.
I don't know if I can...
so on.
Yes, right in front of me. And this person is, you know, a person of authority. I was a little shocked at that statement. Also, there were comments made by other officers in regards to African-Americans and females African-Americans and also Hispanics. I heard it. I witnessed it. I tried to say something. I don't think that I could have ever done enough to stop the behavior.
Right. Well, it doesn't sound like it's just a behavior. It sounds like it was a culture issue.
A culture, yes. And however, on the other hand, you have this group of people there that are good and decent and want to do the right thing. But yet you have this looming cloud that when you're around it, it's such an oppression, such an oppressive workplace. And what did I do that they felt comfortable making those comments around me or in a group when I was there?
I think there's sometimes a sort of sense that if somebody can say something discriminatory in front of you and you don't stop it, you don't say, hey, what are you talking about, that you could be sort of co-opted into it, which is probably part of how that culture develops.
Yes.
Did you witness any changes in that culture over the 15 years that you were there? I mean, did it get better? Did it get worse? What happened?
Yes and no. I believe it definitely existed prior to me leaving.
Mm-hmm.
It did get better.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it lessened.
Okay.
And this new generation of people joining the force, they seem to be more aware of what their rights are.
Mm-hmm.
They are willing to stand up against a fear-based autocratic leadership. They're not afraid.
And so you think it's maybe continuing to get better?
I want to hope so, yes. I think that things like these will always exist. These discriminations will always exist, but I definitely think it's a little bit easier for those that are there now.
What are the statistics in terms of the makeup of the police department, in terms of race and gender?
Boy, I know I've been away from there for 3 years and 4 months. 22 hours and 4 minutes, but who's counting? So obviously I'm very happy with the move I made. I don't believe I'm not sure. I couldn't give you an accurate stat, but I know that the number, it appears, if you're looking at it from an outsider's view, it appears that the amount of white males definitely outnumber African American males, females.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how many in the Hispanic community have been hired since I've been gone.
Right.
But definitely this outweighs this in diversity.
Did you see any of that sexism, homophobia, racism? Did you see it playing out in terms outside the police department itself, in terms of interaction with the public?
As far as my experiences going out and...
Yeah, I mean, when you would see, you know, what the police were doing, I mean...
I mean, there were... Yes, absolutely. Especially... I observed in the Hispanic communities, the communities where there's poverty,
mm-hmm.
and predominantly African Americans or Hispanics or mm-hmm. single females, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were some negative behaviors there. And I want to believe that it was a minority of the officers mm-hmm. doing that. And I did take personal action on a couple situations where I pulled that person aside. And then, of course, there goes the reputation that, you know, I'm an expletive that begins with a B.
Right, of course.
But that was hurtful to me to watch or see because of somebody's race, where they live, what they did, what they drove. Who cares if they've been arrested before? You know, we're dealing with them now. This is now.
Right.
It was just a lot of things held against people out in general public. You know, it did happen. I'd like to say it happened less than 50% of the time.
And when you say it happened, what do you mean, Pam? I mean, what did you see happen?
Profiling.
Tell me.
No doubt in my mind.
What do you mean by
profile?
You'd
be standing, having coffee with a group of officers. Sometimes you were just stuck with who was there getting coffee at the same place.
Right.
And somebody would see a car go by with an individual in it and make a comment, well, that's a suspended driver right there. Or look at that car.
Well, they were driving while Latino?
Yes.
That kind of...
Yeah, heard that often.
Mm-hmm.
African-American, same thing.
Mm-hmm. And would the officers then go stop that person?
Yeah, occasionally.
And
yes.
What was the reason for the stop?
In all honesty, I don't know. I can only speculate that there was maybe something wrong with the car, cracked windshield.
Right.
Something minor. Something that normally, if you're out on patrol, are you going to go out of your way to turn around and stop that car?
Right.
For a license plate light out? Is that what you're really going to do? That to me was not my job.
You think if it had been a white guy in a suit, that the same officer wouldn't have stopped that car for the license plate light out?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And depending on the area that you were working.
Tell me about that.
We were all assigned areas.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain areas that had a tendency to have higher call volume for criminal activity than others. So hovering in those areas was always encouraged to protect, mm-hmm. quote unquote, protect that community.
Mm-hmm.
And all, you know, and then there were officers that I feel took advantage of that to profile and stop people and use that to effect an arrest or a traffic stop when normally they wouldn't.
Right.
I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah. I think what you're saying, and tell me if I'm wrong, is because you're hanging out in a high crime area, and the place designated as a high crime area happens to be a mostly black or mostly Latino area of town, that then they would make many more stops there than they would in a white area.
Absolutely what I was trying to say. Thank you for...
I got it. Mm-hmm. Well, aren't there more license plates out? License plate lights out in the black area of town than in the white area of town? If I go to one of the fancy, wealthy subdivisions up here that's mostly white, will I find any license plate lights out?
You probably will, but who's going to get stopped for that? And, you know, the money fixes the car. And that
right.
just wasn't up my alley.
Right.
And it wasn't up a lot of officers' alley.
I got it.
Those are things you had to walk away from.
And when those officers then went to court and they were asked what the reason for the stop is, would they say, you know, I saw this black guy driving a car that was run down?
Well, in reality, we'd all like somebody to be honest like that, you know, but no.
Of course not. Yeah. No, right?
No,
they'd give
absolutely
some...
Absolutely not.
You know, I've heard tire tread depth. That's
yes.
one of my favorite ones.
And I love if you can see that tire tread at a car going 35 miles an hour, man, I want your powers.
Right. Right. I gotcha. Well, what do you think about, I guess I should probably say now, because I'm supposed to say this, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, and this is Straight Talk, and my guest is Pam Greenwood, who's a 15-year veteran in the Albemarle County Police Department. What are your thoughts on, you know what, I'm gonna go ahead and take a break right now. We'll be right back. I wanted to move on to another topic, and I didn't want to do it when I had 2 minutes left to
sure.
of airtime. Talk to me a little bit. There's been a lot of conversation lately about body cameras and the idea that maybe if we outfit police officers with these cameras, that this might improve behavior, civility on the part of the officers, or might give more credibility to their testimony when they're saying something happened. And if you can see it right on the video, then it happened. Or more credibility to the civilian's testimony who says that's not what happened. What do you think about the idea of body cameras? I mean, you were a cop for 15 years. What do you think about that?
I would have gladly worn one.
Really?
Yes. Had absolutely... Everybody makes mistakes. I made mistakes as a patrol officer. I made mistakes. Honest mistakes. I didn't go out of my way to take somebody, you know, and use my badge of authority to abuse them, let's say. I would have absolutely no problem wearing one, and I think that they should be implemented for the protection of our community and also for the protection of the good officers. I was accused of excessive force one time during a traffic stop interaction.
And what happened?
I was exonerated, but it was because I had a microphone on.
Uh-huh.
And I wish there would have been video with it, although you can hear everything very, very clear on my mic. And it was absurd. This person actually tried to go to the Commonwealth Attorney and get a warrant for assault and battery,
uh-huh.
which was completely false.
Right.
So I was really glad that audio was available in the entire exchange. And I even told the gentleman, you know, I said, I have, you know, an audio on it. We're
having this conversation.
This is happening. You know, I always let people know, hey, you're being recorded.
Right.
I just didn't believe in hiding that.
Right.
especially doing an interview with somebody or questioning them on something that had just happened.
When you're talking about audio, here's my understanding of how that has worked over the last decade or so, which is that the cars have cameras in them, and they basically show the view out the windshield of the vehicle. And sometimes there are internal cameras as well, so you can see what's going on in the cage in the back. And that you have a microphone that is worn on your uniform that is tied into that camera system in the car.
That's right.
And the problem is, of course, that sometimes you're not physically in a place where the camera will catch what is happening if
Correct.
It's just in the car looking out the front window.
Right.
Whereas if you had a body camera, it would be catching what's happening from your perspective. But that those microphones, you have the ability to toggle on and off the microphone as an officer, that you can, there's a button, my understanding, that you can push on your belt that turns that microphone on or turns it off during the interaction.
Yes, it was at the time that I was still working there. And there was the impression put on us by supervision that if you were to manipulate the camera or the audio in any way, you would be disciplined for it.
Mm-hmm.
However, it seemed like there was always a loophole around it. Well, there was interference. It cut off. My battery died. There were excuses for things that weren't recorded, excuses for things that were recorded on camera.
I can't tell you how many DUI videos I've watched where the cop toggles off the audio and then has a conversation separate
right.
outside from the audio and then comes back and toggles it back on.
Yep,
that's not what's supposed to happen?
No, it shouldn't happen. There was supposed to be disciplinary action that followed if you did deviate.
I see.
At the time, there was an SOP in place for it. I couldn't rattle it off
right.
to you line by line. You just weren't supposed to mess with those systems.
I see. You told me the other day about something you witnessed once where there was a... I was asking you about police brutality, basically, mm-hmm. and you talked about something you saw. Can you describe that?
Sure. I was backing up an officer on the interstate. It was an officer with statewide jurisdiction.
Okay.
So not from my agency.
Right.
And I pulled up behind him.
Uh-huh.
He had two individuals on the ground, one of which was looked like a barely maybe 90-pound female with her hands handcuffed behind her back.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some pill bottles on the back of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking to them pretty harshly mm-hmm. and rudely. Regardless, I mean, we all get high-strung.
Right.
And sometimes you're going to speak a little more aggressively.
Right.
I immediately felt uncomfortable and felt like he was out of line.
Right.
And I noticed the female wiggling, and I said, hey,
when you say wiggling, what do you mean?
She was moving around on her bottom on the ground, mm-hmm. like even in the gravel. She had a short skirt on.
Mm-hmm.
So she was definitely trying to move something mm-hmm. or get in a position where he wouldn't see something.
Mm-hmm.
So I was watching her. I knew that there wasn't a weapon. No way was there a weapon. You
right.
could clearly see the clothes were tight to her body.
Right.
And I just asked her, you know, please stay still. Let
right.
him finish his search, and then, you know.
Right.
Well, he turned around at the same time, walked over, picked her up by the throat, and slammed her onto the side of the road.
Picked her up by
yes.
the throat?
Picked
you
her up
lift
by
her
the,
off the ground?
Her feet and body came off the ground.
And slammed her, as in from a standing position, having picked her up?
He was bent over when he picked her up,
uh-huh.
so it was,
okay.
he was close. It wasn't like he picked her up
right.
over her head. It was
right.
like this sliding, picking up motion, and then he pounded her on the side of the road.
And she was handcuffed?
Yes.
At the time he did this?
Mm-hmm.
Did this happen to be captured on video?
It was on my video, and I actually immediately turned into authority figures.
Did you talk to the officer who had done this? Did you say anything?
I did. I pulled him aside, and I said, I'm not sure what just happened. And he said, well, I thought she was reaching for a weapon.
Uh-huh.
And I said, clearly she doesn't have a weapon. And then...
Well, and her hands are cuffed.
Yes.
Behind her.
Yes.
But she was reaching for a weapon.
Right, according to him.
Okay.
So then a person from his agency pulled up,
uh-huh.
and I just looked at him, and I said, I'm leaving. And I did tell him, I have that on video.
Right.
And he just, like, he didn't care.
Right.
And I went back, and I reported it, turned it in, and I didn't have access to remove, at the time, the disc from my car, and I was told that it was going to be handled.
Right.
And to this day, I don't know that it was ever handled. The officer still, I believe, is still out there.
So when you say it wasn't handled, how do you know?
I just don't. I didn't have access to unlock the DVD.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My there were persons of authority interested in seeing the video footage, mm-hmm. which they observed. They at the time had the opportunity to withdraw the disc.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say that it was withdrawn and put somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and that's the last that I knew of it.
I see.
Okay. Yeah, the systems could be manipulated and tampered with, and they were.
How often did you see something like that?
That happened quite a bit. Camera systems would be quote unquote down, and they did in all fairness, they did break quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But you were supposed to report that immediately, and then mm-hmm. there was somebody in charge of trying to get that fixed.
Mm-hmm.
However, that was very lax. I don't recall ever having somebody come to me and say, "Your camera's broken. Go get it fixed now."
Right.
Because then you'd be off to the next call.
Right.
And it basically came down to that officer's responsibility to get it fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't, are you going to get reprimanded for it?
Right.
Well, that was hit and miss. Some people were reprimanded for it.
Right.
Some people were just told, hey, next time, don't let that happen again.
Right.
Very inconsistent.
The way the camera systems worked, there's a dash cam in the car. That's the same camera we're talking about, right?
We actually started out with, what are they, beta
mm-hmm.
camera? It was actually one of the old video cameras bungee strapped to the dashboard of my car.
Uh-huh.
And some people had VHS.
Right.
Yeah. And those, we had to manually hit record.
Right.
So through the years, they did improvements. But yeah, towards the end there, the camera system was tied to your audio on your belt or mm-hmm. on your sleeve.
My understanding is that the where the data is stored, where the recording is stored, is in a locked cage in the trunk of the car these days.
Yes.
And the idea is that you can't get into it. The officer who's
no.
Who's driving the car, who's presumably their interactions are being recorded,
right.
that they can't get in there and tamper with that.
That's correct.
System.
And I believe now there's even a direct feed into the agency.
I think there's a download now.
A download, yeah. I believe so.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm very behind. I've been away three years, 4 months.
Right.
And I left and didn't look back.
I understand. Did you ever see anybody tampering with any of those systems? Did you ever, when you said, you know, tamper, I'm wondering what you mean. I mean, was there ever a time when an officer erased something off their camera that had been recorded? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. At one point, we had the disc directly in
mm-hmm.
our
mm-hmm.
in our car
mm-hmm.
where we drove, in, next right above the driver's seat.
Mm-hmm.
Many times when an officer was involved in a pursuit or something stressful, hot mm-hmm. call, all of a sudden their camera would fail. I observed many of these. At one point, I was a supervisor, so mm-hmm. I was pulling DVDs
mm-hmm.
and, you know, reviewing what had happened
mm-hmm.
on high-stress, high-profile calls,
mm-hmm.
and would ask, why is your video blanked out at this point?
Mm-hmm.
It just quit, Sarge. I'm not sure what to tell you. Really? So then that was, you know, another investigation.
Right.
Which you could never conclusively say that that video camera failed, because they did fail a lot. And it
right.
was, unless I'm a technological expert
right.
in these types of video cameras, I couldn't without a doubt say, you know what, you tampered with that.
Right.
But we knew.
But could you shut it off if you wanted to while you were in the car?
Yes.
I see. Well, tell me about your best day on the street. What was your best day?
My best day.
You must have done some. You must have had some great adventures.
I did, and my best day was actually went to a UVA football game when I was a mentor for a local high school, and I was there in plain clothes, still on duty, mentoring these awesome kids, and a photographer from that school walked in, who happens to be my wife now.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be the best day of my life. Plus, I got to meet a football player, get his autograph.
So right.
That just topped the day off. It has to be one of the best days of my life.
But the day you meet your wife is a good day.
Yep. There you go.
I gotcha. Tell me about the thing you're proudest of having accomplished as an officer.
The thing I'm proudest of. I don't like to toot my own horn, so.
Well, I'm asking you to.
My proudest moments are probably the time I I did a couple projects in some neighborhoods that hadn't had much positive police interaction.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm still friends with many of those people today.
Mm-hmm.
One of the proudest moments was when my Explorer group, which was another group that was kind of like Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, where young people wanted to be police officers. And so I led an Explorer Camp Academy for mm-hmm. these young people. One of their first graduations is they put together a complete PowerPoint with this incredible song and how they thanked me and how they felt their life changed because of me. And not all of them went on to be police officers, but I'm still actually friends with half of that group today.
Mm-hmm.
I still see them. They're successful. And that's the best feeling in the world when I see these kids. And maybe that 10 minutes extra I spent with them changed their moment for the rest of their life.
Or maybe changed their impression of police.
Or police. And they definitely changed mine. They made an impression on me. Just like they feel I made an impression on them, I carry them right here in my heart. So,
you were the first officer, I think, in Albemarle to bring a dogfighting
yes.
charge.
yeah,
and I know you're a big animal lover.
Yes, I am.
So tell me a little bit about that. That's a good story.
Absolutely. Received a call one night for an alleged dogfighting ring out in the western part of our county, and I thought, oh man, I've never dealt with this. What do I do? Immediately, you know, start thinking in your head, what am I going to do if I do find this happening?
Mm-hmm.
Get there, and sure enough, there are large stadium lights set up. There's a dirt ring, and there are about 5 dogs chained up in the middle of winter in these tiny dog houses with straw.
Mm-hmm.
One dog was profusely bleeding from its ear into its water ball and just looked devastated and mm-hmm. sad. Broke my heart immediately. There were no humans. There were no people. We're on site. So went into action. Got into the code book. What can I take? What can I do? What do I need?
Mm-hmm.
And we launched an investigation. We ended up seizing all the dogs, the dogfighting accessories, so to speak, mm-hmm. and then initiated a search warrant on the residents. We effected a positive arrest. And unfortunately, the dogs, all but one, were euthanized. They were damaged according to, you know, the laws that, you know, govern the animals. I believe the puppy survived. But we did get a conviction. And that was actually one of my best days in court. Other than helping domestic situations and things like that. But, yeah, but I was interviewed by the news,
mm-hmm.
not to be long-winded, but it was like, I guess, my 10 minutes of fame that I was the first person in Central Virginia.
Not just Albemarle.
Not just Albemarle, Central Virginia, to locate, find, investigate, and get a successful prosecution in a dogfighting ring.
Wow. Well, congratulations. Unless, yeah, of course, it was my client, in which case.
No. Well, I wouldn't have gotten a conviction, right?
Right, exactly. You're right. Tell me about your birthday.
My worst day. I was involved in an accident in which I struck and killed a pedestrian in my patrol vehicle, which happened to be an SUV. And, you know, I got out and administered as much first aid as I thought I could, controlled the scene until an officer arrived to assist. That and the aftermath, that was the most difficult time as a police officer. I've completed a lot of, I don't know what you call it, internal work,
right,
to deal with it. It's something that will always stay with me. I know that it was not my fault now.
But it probably felt horrific at the time.
Horrific, and as the years followed, I always felt that I should have done more, could have done more to help this person. And shortly before I left the department, I was able to watch the video, which actually helped in my healing process because I saw that I didn't fail her.
Right.
But it is something I'll always carry with me. It's a life-changing experience, and I would never, ever want anybody to experience that, ever. We're taught to protect lives. We're taught to protect ourselves. You know, we're taught to help people. And when something like that happens to a person in that position where you're out there to help. It was quite devastating.
I understand. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back.
Sure.
So we're back on the air, 94.7 WPBC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk. My guest today is Pam Greenwood, and we're talking about experiences as a police officer for 15 years with Albemarle. You know, you've told me about that accident case before. I remember talking to you about it. But you also, you tied it in for me in one conversation we had by talking about another experience you had where you had a runner, an 18-year-old, who I think had gone missing.
Yes.
And you'd gone looking for him.
Yes.
And I think at some point when I was talking to you about what your worst day was, one of the things you told me was about that.
Absolutely.
Experience. And this young man had basically died of heat stroke.
Yes.
And later on, when you'd had this car accident, you got a call from that boy's mom.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, we had been in touch briefly on and off after the horrific thing happened. And it touched my heart immediately, meeting the family.
You mean the boy, the runner?
Yes. Yeah. In meeting the family, having to give death notification, you form a bond, I guess an unspoken bond with certain people in a situation like that. So years later, after the pedestrian accident, which I was involved, she reached out to me and we had coffee.
And when she called you, what did she tell you she wanted to talk to you about?
She wanted to talk to me about the details of what happened
to her son
and what he experienced when I was there on the scene.
And when you agreed to have coffee with her, what did she actually end up talking to you about?
She actually was checking on me and my welfare after hearing about the accident. And we did talk about her son, but I felt that I was with my mom.
She was really taking care of you.
She was taking care of me.
Because you had tried to help their family during that experience. And so she called you up telling you that she needed some more details. She wanted some more help from you.
Yes.
In order to get you to go there to talk to her.
Yeah.
Because probably if she'd called you up and said, Pam, I just want to know if you're okay, you would have said, oh, I'm fine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wonderful person.
So she kind of tricked you into going.
Yeah, she did. She somehow knows me, you know, Ken. Uh-huh. Wonderful person, wonderful family, wonderful person that we lost in the community. Obviously, I'm very emotional still.
Yeah, you're tearing up. I mean, I'm, you know, kind of sitting here watching it happen. I mean, that story kind of made an impression on me.
Many things affect you throughout your career, but certain things touch you. And that entire family in that incident touched me.
When the accident happened and the woman died, I understand you went to the funeral.
Yes, I did. They had a memorial for her at her church.
Why did you do that?
Well, I wanted to let her family and her community know that I cared. It wasn't something I wanted to happen.
Right.
Genuinely out of the center of my heart. Wanted them to know. I was sorry that she and I met that way. And that I do care about this community. I cared very much, and so to experience that with somebody that maybe the day before you had helped with something, that was quite a lot.
That woman who died in that accident, she was a Latina woman.
Yes.
And there were some connections of hers who were not real happy with you.
Yes.
Was it believed that you had tried to hit her?
Yes. I was scrutinized by many people in the community, not only the Hispanic community, Latino community, but also just general public felt that, you know, the police department was covering up a scandal.
Right.
And I was often stopped on the street just walking and asked, hey, aren't you the officer that killed that woman?
Right.
And then I was receiving these third-party threats from the, it was believed to be Mara Salvatrucha gang members.
MS-13?
Yes. You know, so I carried my gun with me constantly. I was on administrative leave after the accident. I was terrified at times, experiencing the trauma, the after trauma, the shock, the adrenaline, the PTSD that goes with it. So I was more than hypervigilant walking around.
And here you are, you're getting death threats, and you decide to go to this funeral.
Yes.
Tell me what happens at the funeral.
The pastor was incredible and asked everybody to welcome me there. And for the most part, after the service, and I actually went up and asked for forgiveness in front of the entire congregation. And he gave me a blessing. And afterwards, several members came up and gave me a hug. And then a woman, which, you know, I thought would be more, came up and started screaming, yelling at me, and tried to slap me.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was kind of held back by other church members. And I just apologized over and over, profusely apologized. And then I was taken out. I was there with a friend.
Right.
And my friends said, we need to go. It's, you don't need to do this to yourself. But to me, it wasn't doing it to myself. It was like letting them know
that this was an accident. And
yeah.
I understand. That must have been a terrible thing.
It was awful, but, you know, I was so messed up about the whole thing. I almost felt like I deserved that woman screaming at me.
Why? Tell me what happened in the accident, Pam. I mean, what happened?
It was... Actually, I was really happy that night. I was having a great night at work, and I was traveling towards a light. And I always got paranoid at intersections. My police car, you know, because people get fascinated when they see a police car or get right. nervous. And I was always afraid of being T-boned. So I had slow. It was a 35-mile-an-hour speed zone. I was listening to Hootie and the Blowfish. And I'm just looking around. It's very dark in this part of the county. No lights, no street lights. Slowed down to go through an intersection. And it was like this person landed out of nowhere. And I immediately cut my wheels mm-hmm. to avoid her,
mm-hmm.
but I ended up striking her, and she rolled over the top side of my car.
What happened? I mean, why did that happen? Were you not paying attention? Was she not paying attention? What
well,
happened?
Well, I was looking at the road straight ahead. She had a cell phone that was would have blinded her peripheral vision in her right hand as she was crossing.
She was talking on the phone. And
apparently she had just bought a house.
At the time, though, you probably didn't know this.
Had no idea. I mean, it was like, it was pitch black, and then there was a person there.
Right. So this happens, you don't have the benefit of hindsight. And then later on, you looked at your dash cam.
Yes.
And could see that was
yes
what had happened. I understand. How long was that before you left the force?
I stayed another 9 years, I think. I left in... Oh, actually, I only stayed an additional 5.
But you stuck around.
Sorry, 2007. June 26, 2007, and I left in 2012. That would have been 5 years. Just checking my math. I did stick around because basically I was requested 2 days after the accident to come back to work, that I should get back on the horse.
Okay.
And my mom was here after it had happened, taking care of me, God bless her. And she was the one that actually drove me to the police department when this interaction happened.
Right.
and she was very livid about it. And
because she felt like you weren't.
No way mentally able to get back into a police car at that time.
When did you go back?
I was on leave. I want to say I went back the mid part of August or late August, which in retrospect, I think was too soon. And the first call I went on was a fatality accident in which somebody I knew. That was... Yeah, so the irony there. So I played it off like anybody else would, any good troop. Any person that... You got to be tough, you got to get through this. You know, this is my life, this is my job, I'm going to do it. And just put the facade on. And behind closed doors, I was suffering.
I understand. Was the department supportive of you? Did you feel like you got any help?
No.
What do you mean, no? No's kind of a short answer.
Not at all. I sought help on my own.
You mean counseling?
Yes. I was constantly being asked when I was going to come back. I was asked to provide a medical statement, mental health statement, about myself.
Mm-hmm.
Which my wonderful therapist, I just want to give her props. I would say her name, but I don't know if I can. She was incredible. Changed my life. And I'm glad I found her.
Helped you get through it?
Yes. However, the agency didn't offer any help, didn't offer any follow-up, didn't offer a support group. We have a critical incident stress debrief team. At one occasion, bombarded my house during the time that I was on administrative leave. I cut my phone off. I didn't want to talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I made a conscious choice. My mother and I mm-hmm. sat at my house, and we were just... getting through this. They came out to my house about 5 to 7 police cars. Good-hearted people.
Right.
However, I didn't want it.
Right. So maybe you didn't get some of it because you just weren't ready for it at that
right.
point in time. Didn't you say that at the hospital, someone was trying to get you to make a statement?
Yeah, there was a demand for me to give a statement at that point in time.
Right.
And I was in shock.
Right.
And
we're talking about like an hour or two after this has happened.
Probably an hour, yeah. And somebody's in shock is not going to be able to give you a clear statement of fact.
Right. How does that compare to some of what you've seen with other situations like that, where officers have been involved in a fatality, maybe an officer shooting or another accident?
They're often demanded. Hey, I want to get a statement from you.
Give us a statement right now.
Yeah. And some officers choose to. I just literally wasn't in the state of mind, too. I was in disbelief that this thing had even happened.
It's a tough place to be in.
Yeah.
So we have just a couple more minutes left. And so I just want to ask you kind of, you know, where are you now? How you doing now?
Life is good. I have a wonderful family. I have 3 kids, one of which is a little girl that's going to be 15 months, a wonderful wife. We've settled into our life outside of this county. I have an incredible job that I love, very supported there, and can be myself. I am a lesbian at work.
Nope, yep, not getting propositioned?
Not being propositioned,
no.
Yeah. So life is on point for me. And I appreciate the experiences that I've had. Excuse me. Even the bad. You know, it brought me to a place where I can actually live my life. I can see beauty in things now. It took me a long time to decompress from that place. And sometimes I don't think I'm fully decompressed. But overall, the beauty that overtakes the stuff that I've been through outweighs that.
Well, Pam, I just want to say thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you for having me. And... thank you to everybody out there doing the right thing.
Thank you for being here today and sharing all of this. And thank you for all the things you have done for this community.
I appreciate that.
You're a good bunny, Pam.
So are you.
All right. Well, we're wrapping up. This is Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Next Saturday at 10 a.m., we're going to be talking with Charlottesville attorney Steve Rosenfield and his client Robert Davis, who was recently released from prison after serving 12 years for homicide. And he was pardoned, and apparently because the view now is that he did not commit that homicide, and that he was, in fact, implicated by the people who did just out of sheer meanness and served 12 years in prison for it. I think it's going to turn out to be we're going to have some conversations about confessions and false confessions and how that kind of thing can happen. Anyway, I'm looking forward to that. I'm Andre Hakes, signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend, everybody.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.